I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program Jane Davis. She is the founder and executive director of Hope House. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. It's great to be back. It's been a while.
It's been a while. So for those listeners who don't know you and don't know Hope House, just give us a brief overview of what this unusual organization does.
We are an all-volunteer organization. We've actually existed since 1993, so we just celebrated 18 years. We're a nonprofit, and we're really very grassroots and have remained so all this time. And
which is a feat in and of itself, I have to say.
It really is. So our focus, even though we really welcome donations and financial support, I personally have put all of my money into it and welcome any of the support we get. But we do programs in communities, Atlanta and here. And Atlanta is where I founded Hope House and where we began after I witnessed an electric chair execution as media. And I never wrote about it. Instead, I had this vision called Hope House. It's an acronym. And it's about being of service to others. It's about being honest, facing oneself. So it's really about accountability, honesty, faith, because you can't go that deep into oneself without faith in something. And the hand of the logo is action and service. So it's kind of a spiritual action on a daily basis to be aware of everything around you and how can you respond to it in a positive way.
It's an unusual organization in the sense that, I mean, we just talked to people from youth shelters and St. Elizabeth's Shelter, and they have a very clear mission, and the animal shelter shelters animals. You do service with a capital S, but it can be anything. You do prison outreach, you take in animals, you work with young people who've lost their way. Basically, kind of this organic whatever comes along, if you're there to serve, then you serve.
Exactly. And so I think it's oftentimes confusing for people to understand what it is Hope House does because of that. And I always say we're of service. And our motto is one heart. And what that means is we're all connected. And so we do a lot of work in the prisons. That started just so we wouldn't forget anybody. But we also work with victims. We're not issue and we're not government, related.
And you're not politicized.
We're not political at all. So even though I have walked 12 men through their executions, have witnessed electric chair as well as lethal.
You've walked 12 men? You've witnessed 12? I thought it was just that one
no,
that changed
no,
your life.
That changed my life. But then I've become a spiritual advisor to many in prison and death row. So I have been asked 12 times to go that walk. And that walk has also encompassed doing mediation with victims' family members. And so it's about healing. Hope House is really about healing. And one of the things that we've really been developing, One Heart Ranch. I bought 30 acres of land that we leased to Hope House. And we have people come out. The land is the healer. And so we've had retreats. We've had people. I love sitting down and reading our guest book because people from all over the world have found their way there. And we have a three-tiered bonfire pit and a little house right now with a solar. It's all, green and it's sustainable. And our hope is to work with, we merge community with people coming out of prison as well so that we have a model that's, again, very grassroots where we can help people coming out of prison to get jobs. And we're not
which
a halfway
house.
Which
is really, really hard. I mean, you can't even get a job at Walmart if you come out of prison because all of the chain stores have that question about, have you ever been convicted of a felony?
Right.
I mean, there's no backup.
It's very hard. And one of the things we do is we will work with registered sex offenders, which a lot of people go, but we work with human beings from all walks of life. And so it's about healing and about the connected. And I also want to, again, say it's about accountability. So we all have to be accountable. The degree is different. But if we think of spiritual teachings and principles, we think about forgiveness. How does one forgive? And so forth. And that's why we do a lot of mediation. And we show up for people. It's about showing up.
I asked you once about prisoners and forgiveness. And you gave me a very surprising answer, which was that the greatest act of forgiveness that you see is not victims, families forgiving prisoners, but prisoners forgiving their own families that abused them.
That's a big part. That's a very big part of the process. And so, you know, one of the things I'm always curious about, the human mind and human nature, and, you know, how did someone end up at this point? And if you think, you know, obviously we're all born innocent, beautiful children, then life happens and we end up. So that's where accountability is important. So understanding is not an excuse for behavior. So if one commits certain crimes, then one has to pay the time and do the time. But we can understand, and most people are rejoining society. So even though we're not focused on that as a goal, I think that we do affect change, and we have affected lower recidivism rates as a result of our model, which is about human dignity and respect regardless of what one has done. Now, if somebody is a true psychopath, it's different. It's much harder to deal with someone who's a psychopath and expect or affect change. So
I would imagine those are the people with the highest recidivism rate.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and so there's, it's such a complex human, let's just say human nature is so complex. And I think that if society could focus more on that whole issue of forgiveness, it's not society's place to forgive someone who did something to someone else, but I think if we embedded ourselves with more practice of forgiveness on individual paths, then our justice system would be kinder and gentler.
We're talking to Jane Davis of Hope House. Let's go back to this ranch that you, this piece of land that you bought. You said a moment ago the land itself is a healer, and I was thinking about something that I read in your little biography that's on your website, which I didn't know, which is that you used to work with wild animals.
I did. I went to college and graduate school at Washington University in St. Louis and had the good fortune to work for Dr. Michael Fox, who was one of the original bioethicists and animal psychologists who started doing work with wolves in this country. He had the first wolf sanctuary outside of St. Louis. And I got hired by him to be his teaching assistant. And part of that was working with the wolves and coyotes and coy dogs, where he would breed coyotes and beagles.
And really?
Yes. Yeah, so I had to go take these little wild animals and walk them in the quad when class was in session. And the way I would catch them was I had to become the dominant, you know, the leader
the
of
alpha.
The pack. I was quite the alpha. And one day one of the dogs ran into a large, you know, it was one of these big, you know, 101 classes where they're like 300 freshmen.
Right.
And I was chasing this little coy dog around, growling until I was so dominant that she rolled over on her back and I caught her. But to this day, some people still remind me of that incident. But
yes, the freshman whose formative experience was this growling lady.
Yeah. And Dr. Fox actually was one of the first members of our board of directors. And he's now retired, but he went on to be senior vice president of the Humane Society of America. And so he always was still kind of involved. The whole concept of animals, also combining animals with humans and healing, we have two therapy dogs, Hogan and Magic, who you've met. Magic being the little wild one, and Hogan being like a bodhisattva who stares at the moon and communes with the stars. And we've expanded our work community service-wise to the Kingston Residents Memory Care. And in that, we have a volunteer, Dana, who brings her dog Shadows, this large. I forget what kind it is. It's big. And so she brings Shadow into Kingston Residence.
What's Kingston Residence?
Kingston Residence is an assisted living facility in Santa Fe, and it has a separate memory care for people with dementia and Alzheimer's. And so one of our programs in the prison is that we've been bringing in music. And, you know, I just can't praise the local musicians enough. And all of you local musicians who are listening, thank you. We bring monthly concerts into the prison. We were cut back to quarterly, but I think we're now back to monthly. And so a lot of the musicians are starting to also donate their time and come into the residence, Kingston Residence. So again, that's part of, you know, we're not about prison issues, prison reform. We're about community service. And that, I think it's a level below volunteering, because we're not just about volunteering. We really want to infuse people to, on a daily basis, to be aware. How can you be of service? Like, with whatever comes into your sphere. So, you know, that's why we don't have blinders on with a particular thing that we do, because, as you said, it's service with a capital S. And it could be you walk out of the movie theater and there are kids sitting on the floor and you notice one is troubled. I mean, these are real, actually.
Did you do that?
Yes.
What
and
happened?
To this day, well, there were. This was, oh my goodness, about 6 years ago, and I was in DeVargas Mall with friends going out for dinner, and we walked out heading for dinner, and there were three or four kids sitting on the floor, and one of them stood out, and he just, I don't know if he didn't fit, but that intuitive voice said there's something. So I sat down with him. And
was he surprised?
Kind of, but we talked, and then I looked in his eyes, and I said, listen, here's my number. All I can tell you is I really do care about you. I care about our community. If ever you want some support or you just want to talk, here's my number. But it's also, it's not my place. I can't fix anyone, but I can reach out. And about 2 weeks later, he called, and he was 15. He had dropped out of school. He was having issues. So I actually really did get involved with him. And today he's a great member of our community.
And what did you do? What was your interaction with him like?
Well, I did. I use this term a lot, showing up, but I was present for him. He was having some issues with his father. And I offered if he wanted me also to speak with his father. So we all got together. I opened my home to him. You know, and that's another thing that I do that not everybody is willing to or maybe can do. But I really have practiced trusting my intuition for so long that, my home is open. My home is open when that intuition tells me I'm okay. Now, that doesn't mean I'm always going to be okay, but that's what leads me.
But your intuition probably, I would think, keeps people away also who you think might be harmful to you.
Correct. Absolutely. I have very strong boundaries. And because I don't have any illusion of, you know, healing the world or fixing this one, that's not present. I understand how to be of service.
We're talking to Jane Davis of Hope House. Jane, talk more about the process of forgiveness. I mean, with the people who are on death row, you've seen them through the last days of their life and their execution. There's a process of forgiveness and coming to terms that can happen.
You know, thank you, Mary Charlotte, for asking that. There's one, I mean, and here's one of many stories, but one that stands out was a young man on death row in Texas. And when I met him at the request of his parents who had heard about Hope House and the work I was doing. And when we first met, as a matter of fact, this story is on the website and it also is written in Chicken Soup for the Prisoner Soul,
right,
which is a very inspiring book, and I have two stories in it. But, you know, one of the first things Larry identified with me is what he wanted to work on before his execution was to do whatever work he could with his family, the victims' families, of healing. Now, one of the catches to that is, by almost in every state, by policy, a perpetrator cannot contact any victims' families because it could stir things up. It has, that request must come from the victims or victims' families. And so actually in this case, the victims' families also were familiar with my work, so it worked both ways. They actually did contact me. And so we did, I did mediation, and there were, in his case, there were five victims. He had been diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic as a teenager. His parents could not get help for him because he was never violent. One day, he mass murdered five people. And instead of getting any kind of help, he was sentenced to death and was executed. And he worked really hard. I saw him frequently. I visited Texas Death Row. And I remember the day after he was executed, I was given some of his belongings, and I was given a letter that he had written that he wanted distributed to the family. And let me backtrack that. I would go into death row with the family's words written all over my body because I didn't want to infuse myself or my interpretation to their words.
And you couldn't take in paper?
I couldn't take in paper and pen. I couldn't take in anything. So my body, I wore loose clothing, and I had things written all over my legs and arms of their words so that I could say, this one said this. And some were, you know, you scumbag, rotten hell. Some were, I'm struggling to forgive you, but I forgive you. You know, it was all a whole mix of emotional response to the horror that he had done to their loved ones. And in the letter that he wrote to them all, one of the lines that stood out was he said, to say I'm sorry seems so shallow. So he asked them for forgiveness, and he really said he still struggles trying to understand why he did what he did. And so it's not clear. I will say this, drugs and alcohol were involved, and I find that the majority of crimes committed, drugs and alcohol are a major factor. So, and the other major, I think, act of forgiveness that I was part of was actually the very first, was Chris Berger's execution in 93, when I didn't know Chris. He was the only person whose execution I witnessed that I didn't know.
This was the very first one?
The very first one, on December 7th, 1993. And I was very familiar with his file. I was there as a media witness, so I was familiar with his case, with him. I read his medical file. And he had suffered tremendous abuse. I mean, unconscionable from his mother and her boyfriends. And, I mean, including being locked out in the winter for 4 days. She and her boyfriend were going away and locked him outside in the snow. He was 7 years old.
You know, I just have to say, having just talked to the people from youth shelters, we have stories like this going on in Santa Fe right now,
right,
where parents are locking their kids out of the house.
Right.
And here's what happens later in
some
cases.
Isn't this amazing? Yeah. Right. And also, she used to lock him in the closet or chain him to the toilet and leave, trying to control him. And so he had convulsions from his brain rattling in his head from such severe beatings. So this child was no longer, quote, normal as we know it. And the week of his execution, his mother was actually present, and I witnessed him forgiving her. And that was very powerful. That was very, very powerful. And then I had worked closely with Henry Lee Lucas in Texas, who was one of our country's notorious serial killers. And Henry has since died in prison of natural causes. But He was also severely abused as a child. And again, I want to emphasize so strongly that when I tell these stories and talk about the abuse, never, ever, ever am I using abuse as an excuse. And I have to reiterate that over and over.
Yeah.
But if we're looking for answers or we want to shift, you know, we want to shift like you're talking about the kids in the youth shelter here. From that group of abused children comes a lot of our criminals yeah. as adults. Because when someone turns 18, they don't all of a sudden, like, become these wonderful citizens and know-it-all.
Right.
So we have to pay attention.
I think that, I mean, your group, your organization, Hope House, isn't necessarily talking about this, but when I hear you and I hear the other folks we've been talking to today, there are very great gaps in the way that our system works. So, for example, a paranoid schizophrenic not getting treatment because he hasn't been violent yet and then going and killing people, that's a real flaw in the system. I mean, nobody who has that illness has the free will not to do that. And for that not to be recognized is not the person's problem any more or less than it is society's problem in not dealing. It doesn't have to be that way.
Well, and it's interesting because I don't even know if you know this, but, you know, some people think that Hope House is my job. Hope House is my passion, and as I said earlier, we're all volunteers, including me. I've always had what I call a day job, and so I'm blessed. I actually am employed by the state of New Mexico, and I work for the Human Services Department Behavioral Health Services Division. So that's where I earn my money. And we address that in behavioral health services. You know, how do we get programs, especially in our frontier and rural state, how do we get them out into the world? And I've been active with compulsive gambling and DWI. And so all I can tell you is there's such phenomenal people working for the state on these systems and on these issues, and I'm kind of proud to be part of it. And also just my passion is with Hope House, just showing up.
Jane, it's just about time to go, but if people want to get involved in Hope House in one way or another, what should they do?
They can call me at 983-6677, and also we are on Facebook, and the email is jane@hopehouse.org, and that's hopehouse.org, and also please visit our website. But I encourage you, be in touch. We need volunteers, and we would love to have you. And also, if anyone out there, it's the end of the year, if you feel so that you need a tax deduction,
and want to make a charitable contribution.
Make a charitable contribution to us. Please help us help others.
Jane Davis, thank you so much for being with us, and we'll see you in the new year.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. And by the way, I'm doing a little survey at facebook.com/radiocafe, so check it out. Give your opinions about the Santa Fe Radio Cafe at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.